Here is a detailed podcast episode about the research paper inconclusive results concerning the association between heart rate variability, personality, and the objectification of lab animals into the conduct of animal testing. Intro music. Welcome to Cutting Edge Discoveries, the podcast that investigates the latest research papers with intrigue and depth. I'm Tom, and joining me as always is my co-host, Jen.
Hello everyone. Today, we're diving into a fascinating paper that explores the psychological factors involved in animal testing. The title is a mouthful, but trust us, this is going to be an intriguing discussion.
That's right, Jen. The paper is called Inconclusive Results Concerning the Association Between Heart Rate Variability, Personality, and the Objectification of Lab Animals into the Conduct of Animal Testing. It was authored by Kevin Vezirian, Bryce Befara-Brett, and Laurent Begay.
This research tackles a really complex and sensitive issue, the use of animals in scientific experiments. The core question the researchers were trying to answer is, what psychological factors might influence a person's willingness to harm lab animals for the sake of scientific progress?
Exactly. The researchers looked at things like heart rate variability, personality traits like social dominance, orientation and empathy, and the way lab animals are perceived, whether they're objectified or personified. The goal was to uncover what might make someone more willing to inflict harm on a lab animal in the name of science.
It's a heavy topic, but an important one. Animal testing is a controversial and ethically fraught practice, yet it remains a necessary part of developing new drugs and treatments. Understanding the psychology behind it could offer important insights.
So what did the researchers find? Well, the results were actually quite inconclusive. As the title suggests, the team didn't uncover the clear associations they were expecting between things like heart rate variability, personality traits, and the objectification of lab animals.
That's right, Tom. The researchers had several key hypotheses going into this study. First, they thought that people with lower heart rate variability, a measure of our ability to regulate emotions and stress, would be more willing to harm lab animals. The idea was that these individuals would be better able to ignore the distress of the animal and focus solely on the scientific goals.
They also hypothesized that personality traits like social dominance, orientation and speciesism, the belief that humans are superior to other animals, would predict a greater willingness to harm lab animals. Conversely, they thought higher levels of empathy would be associated with less willingness to cause harm.
And finally, the researchers wanted to test the idea that objectifying lab animals, rather than personifying them, would reduce the stress response people feel when having to harm them in the name of science. The thinking was that seeing the animals as mere objects, rather than sentient beings, would make it easier to proceed with experiments.
But when they put all of this to the test, the results just didn't bear out. None of the individual psychological factors they measured, not heart rate variability, not personality traits, not even the way the animals were framed, significantly predicted people's willingness to harm the lab animals.
The researchers were really stumped. They had expected to find clear links, but instead ended up with a big question mark. They argue that the study may have simply been underpowered, they didn't have a large enough sample size to detect the subtle psychological effects they were looking for.
That's a common issue in psychological research, where tiny effects can be easily missed without careful experimental design and massive sample sizes. But even with the inconclusive results, this study still offers some valuable insights.
Absolutely. For one, it highlights just how complex and fraught the issue of animal testing really is. There's no simple psychological profile of someone who's willing to harm lab animals. It seems to involve a tangled web of factors that are still not fully understood.
And the fact that simply framing the animals as objects rather than individuals didn't seem to make a difference is quite fascinating. You might expect that dehumanization or objectification would make it easier to inflict harm, but that doesn't appear to be the case here.
Right, it suggests that even when lab animals are intentionally depersonalized, the moral discomfort of causing them harm doesn't necessarily go away. There are likely deeper psychological processes at play that the researchers didn't fully capture in this particular study.
Definitely. And of course, the ethical issues surrounding animal testing remain hugely important. Even if we can't neatly map the psychology behind it, the fact that millions of animals suffer and die in labs every year is something society continues to grapple with.
Absolutely. This research may not have yielded the clear-cut answers the team was hoping for, but it opens the door to so many more questions. What other factors might influence a person's willingness to harm lab animals? How can we better understand and address the moral discomfort that comes with this practice?
Those are the kinds of questions that will no doubt fuel future research in this area. For now, this study serves as a sobering reminder of just how complex the psychology of animal testing really is. There are no easy answers, but continuing to investigate this issue is crucial.
Couldn't agree more, Tom. This was a fascinating dive into a challenging and controversial topic. Even with the inconclusive results, I think this paper highlights the immense value of this kind of cutting-edge research.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us today, listeners. Be sure to subscribe to Cutting Edge Discoveries to catch more episodes exploring the latest scientific discoveries. Until next time, keep exploring. Outro music. Upbeat jingle plays. Are you a researcher struggling to make sense of the inconclusive results on heart rate variability, personality, and the objectification of lab animals?
Then you need Detachment Solutions, the revolutionary new supplement that helps researchers disconnect emotionally from their furry test subjects.
With patented objectification-enhancing technology, Detachment Solutions allows you to view lab animals as nothing more than cold, unfeeling objects. No more moral quandaries or empathetic squirming.
Just pop a Detachment Solution capsule and watch as your heart rate variability plummets and your social dominance orientation skyrockets. Speciesism has never been so easy.
Tired of those pesky feelings of guilt when performing invasive experiments on helpless creatures? Detachment Solutions has you covered.
Available now at your local research supply store. Detachment Solutions disconnect from your conscience and connect with your science. Upbeat jingle fades out.
Here is an informative, entertaining, and detailed podcast episode about the research paper exploring ghost bodily sensations, differences across trait and state experiences, intro music. Welcome to the Illuminating Discoveries podcast, where we dive deep into the latest cutting-edge research and unpack it with expert analysis and compelling storytelling. I'm your host, Tom.
And I'm Jen, your co-host. In today's episode, we'll be exploring an intriguing paper that sheds new light on our experience of spontaneous bodily sensations, things like tingling, itching, or numbness that seem to arise from nowhere.
That's right, Jen. The paper is titled Exploring Ghost Bodily Sensations, Differences Across Trait and State Experiences, and it was authored by Murtu F. Staffiu, Louise S. Delicato, and Anna Seder from Heriot Watt University.
This is really fascinating research that gets to the heart of how we perceive and make sense of our own bodies. The key finding is that there appear to be two distinct levels of processing involved in these spontaneous bodily sensations, what the researchers call a trait level and a state level.
Exactly. At the trait level, people seem to have an overall, general tendency to experience these sensations more intensely and frequently in their whole body compared to just their hands and feet. But at the state level, when people focus on a specific moment, the sensations are experienced equally across the different body parts.
That's a really intriguing distinction. It suggests there may be something like a global representation of the body that shapes our general sense of bodily awareness, versus a more immediate, in-the-moment somatosensory experience. Let's dive in and unpack this in more detail.
Sounds good. The researchers set out to explore two main questions. First, are there differences in the spontaneous sensations people experience in their hands, feet, and whole body? And second, does visual attention affect this experience?
To answer these questions, the researchers had participants complete two different tasks. The first measured their general trait tendency to experience spontaneous sensations, while the second looked at their in-the-moment state experience of these sensations.
In the trait task, participants were asked to recall and report on the past experiences of spontaneous bodily sensations, things like tingling, numbness, itching, or vibrations. They indicated where they felt these sensations, how intense they were, and how frequently they occurred.
And in the state task, participants were asked to sit quietly for 15 seconds with their eyes closed, then report any spontaneous sensations they experienced in that moment across their hands, feet, and whole body.
Interesting. So the trait task was tapping into more of a general, conceptual understanding of their bodily experiences, while the state task was getting at the immediate, perceptual reality.
Exactly. And the researchers found that these two levels of experience differed in some key ways. At the trait level, participants reported significantly stronger spontaneous sensations in their whole body compared to just their feet. But there was no difference between the whole body and the hands.
That's a curious finding. What do you think could explain this pattern?
Well, the researchers propose that the trait-level experience may be related to a higher-order mental representation of the body, something they call somato representation or body image. This is a more abstract, conceptual understanding of our physical self that goes beyond just the immediate sensory input.
I see. So for the whole body, people may have a richer, more coherent representation that includes a stronger sense of spontaneous sensations. But the hands and feet may not be as distinctly encoded in this global body image.
Exactly. The researchers think this more holistic, semantic knowledge of the body shapes the trait-level experience of spontaneous sensations. Whereas at the state level, it's more about the immediate, lower-level somatosensory processing, which doesn't show the same differentiation between body parts.
That makes a lot of sense. It suggests these spontaneous sensations may serve an important function in our bodily self-awareness and perception. By providing ongoing feedback about the boundaries and state of our physical form, they could help maintain a coherent sense of our embodied self.
Absolutely. And the researchers note that this distinction between trait and state experiences is reminiscent of the difference between trait and state anxiety. Trait anxiety refers to a general, underlying tendency, while state anxiety is a more transient, situational experience.
That's a great analogy. It highlights how these spontaneous sensations seem to operate at both a general, abstract level and a more immediate, perceptual one. Very intriguing.
Indeed. And the researchers also looked at whether visual attention plays a role in these experiences. They had participants complete a visual attention task, then divided them into groups based on their performance, those with high visual attention and those with low.
And what did they find? Did visual attention make a difference in how people experienced the spontaneous sensations?
Interestingly, no. The researchers found that visual attention ability didn't affect the spontaneous sensations at either the trait or state level. Participants with high visual attention showed no difference in their sensations compared to those with low visual attention.
That's surprising, given the previous research suggesting a link between visual attention and these types of bodily experiences. I would have expected visual attention to play a role.
You're absolutely right. The researchers note that this finding challenges the idea that visual attention and body image are closely intertwined in shaping these spontaneous sensations. It raises questions about what other factors might be involved.
Very interesting. So it seems these spontaneous sensations may be driven more by some deeper, conceptual representation of the body, rather than just being a product of moment-to-moment sensory processing and attention.
Exactly. The researchers suggest that the trait-level experience, shaped by somato representation, may actually have a stronger influence on the state-level somatosensory experience than the other way around. It's an intriguing idea that our general body image or schema could be guiding our more immediate bodily perceptions.
That's a fascinating possibility. It really highlights how our conscious experience of the body is the result of a complex interplay between top-down and bottom-up processes. The brain isn't just passively registering sensory inputs, but actively constructing our embodied sense of self.
Absolutely. And the researchers note that this distinction between trait and state experiences, and the potential role of body image, could be really important for understanding disorders like illness anxiety, where people hyperfocus on and misinterpret benign bodily sensations.
Good point. Exploring the normal baseline of these spontaneous sensations, and how they relate to our broader body representation, could help inform treatments and interventions for people who struggle with abnormal bodily preoccupations.
Definitely. This is such a fascinating and important area of research. The researchers have really opened up new avenues for understanding the complex interplay between our physical and mental experience of the body.
I agree. This study raises so many intriguing questions about the nature of bodily self-awareness and the mechanisms underlying our sense of embodiment. It's an area that deserves much more exploration.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us today as we unpack this illuminating research on ghost bodily sensations. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss our next deep dive into cutting-edge discoveries.
Until next time, keep exploring. Outro music. Upbeat commercial jingle plays. Are you constantly plagued by strange, unexplained bodily sensations? Tingling, itching, vibrating, sensations that seem to come out of nowhere?
Well, fear not. Introducing the new Somatorepresent-O-Matic 3000, the ultimate solution for all your ghostly bodily needs.
The Somatorepresent-O-Matic 3000 uses advanced somatic imaging technology to map your body's unique trait-level representation. It can detect even the faintest tingles and prickles across your entire corporeal form.
Simply step onto the platform, close your eyes, and let the SomataRepresent Omatic work its magic. Within seconds, it will generate a comprehensive 3D model of your body's spontaneous sensations, from the tips of your fingers to the soles of your feet.
But that's not all. The SomataRepresent Omatic also features a state-of-the-art visual attention module. It can track your eye movements in real time, ensuring that no fleeting phantom sensation escapes its vigilant senses.
Know thyself, people. Unlock the mysteries of your body's secret self with the SomataRepresent Omatic 3000. Available now for the low price of $99.99. Operators are standing by.
Call 1-800-BODY-REP to order your SomataRepresent Omatic 3000 today. Because your body deserves to be heard, jingle plays as the commercial ends. Here is the podcast episode transcript. Hello and welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the fascinating world of cutting-edge research. I'm Tom, and joining me is my co-host, Jen.
Hi everyone. Today, we're excited to discuss a paper that sheds new light on the neural mechanisms underlying loss of consciousness. The title of the paper is Common Signatures of Loss of Consciousness in Human and Macaque Electrocardiogram.
This is a really intriguing study that takes an innovative approach to identifying universal markers of unconsciousness across different species. The researchers were able to find specific features in the brain's electrical activity that can reliably distinguish between wakefulness and propofol-induced unresponsiveness, not just in humans, but also in macaque monkeys.
That's right, Tom. The key insight here is that loss of consciousness, despite being induced by the same anesthetic drug, appears to be accompanied by common neural signatures across these two very different mammalian species. This suggests the existence of shared neuronal mechanisms underlying the transition from awareness to unresponsiveness.
Exactly. And the researchers used a really clever technique called highly comparable time series analysis, or HCTSA, which allowed them to systematically evaluate over 7,000 different features of the brain's electrical signals. This unbiased, data-driven approach is a big departure from previous studies that have tended to focus on a relatively small number of pre-selected metrics.
That's a great point. Rather than relying on a handful of traditional consciousness measures like power in certain brainwave frequencies, the HCTSA tool lets the researchers cast a much wider net. This allows them to potentially uncover novel markers of consciousness that have been overlooked in the past.
Right, and the results are quite compelling. The researchers found several HCTSA features that were able to accurately classify the brain states of both the human and the macaque monkey as either awake or unresponsive under propofol anesthesia. One feature in particular, which characterized the performance of a mathematical model fitting the brain activity, stood out as being highly discriminative in both species.
That's fascinating. So this model-fitting feature was able to pick up on something fundamental about the underlying neural dynamics that changes with the loss of consciousness. It makes me wonder, what exactly is this feature capturing about the brain's activity that differs so reliably between the awake and unconscious states?
That's a great question. The researchers don't dive into the specific neurophysiological interpretation of this particular feature, but the general idea is that features like this one are likely reflecting complex changes in the interactions and information processing within the brain as consciousness is lost.
That makes sense. I imagine as the brain transitions from an awake, responsive state to an unresponsive, anesthetized state, there are broad changes happening in terms of neural communication, information flow, and the overall dynamics of the system. And this model-fitting feature seems to be capturing some signature of those high-level changes.
Exactly. And what's really exciting is that the researchers found this feature was not only discriminative within each species, but it also generalized remarkably well across them. The classifier trained on the macaque data was able to accurately classify the human data, and vice versa. This suggests there may truly be common neural mechanisms underlying loss of consciousness that manifest in similar ways, despite the obvious anatomical differences between human and macaque brains.
That's a really important point. The fact that they were able to find features that worked across species is a major strength of this study. It takes the research beyond just looking at individual differences and gets at more fundamental, universal principles. This could have huge implications for developing better ways to monitor consciousness, not just in humans, but potentially in other animals as well.
Absolutely. And the researchers didn't stop there. They also looked at how the discriminative power of these features might change depending on the amount of training data used. Interestingly, they found that the classifiers trained on as little as 32 epochs, that's only about 6 seconds of data, were able to achieve performance on par with classifiers trained on much larger datasets.
Wow, that's really impressive. Being able to accurately detect changes in consciousness with such a small amount of data could be crucial for real-world clinical applications, where time is often of the essence. It means these techniques might one day be usable for rapid, real-time monitoring of consciousness levels during surgery or other medical procedures.
Exactly. And the researchers also expanded their analysis to look at how the discriminative features varied across different recording sites in the brain. They found that the frontal lobe seemed to be particularly rich in features that could distinguish between wakefulness and unresponsiveness in both the human and macaque data.
That's a fascinating regional specificity. I wonder if this speaks to the frontal lobe's key role in higher-order cognitive functions and self-awareness, processes that would be heavily impacted by the loss of consciousness. It makes sense that this area of the brain would show the clearest signatures of the transition to an unconscious state.
That's a great point. The frontal lobe is known to be involved in things like attention, decision-making, and executive control, functions that are severely disrupted when consciousness is lost. So it stands to reason that this region would be where we'd see the most pronounced neural changes associated with the breakdown of conscious awareness.
This study really is a remarkable step forward in our understanding of the neural underpinnings of consciousness. By identifying common signatures of unconsciousness that span two very different species, the researchers have illuminated some fundamental principles about how the brain transitions between conscious and unconscious states.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, this work has important real-world implications. Being able to reliably detect changes in consciousness levels could lead to major improvements in the monitoring and administration of anesthesia during medical procedures. It could help prevent the devastating issue of intraoperative awareness, where patients inadvertently experience the surgery while supposedly unconscious.
That's a great point. Anesthesia is truly a double-edged sword, necessary for safe and humane surgical outcomes, but also carrying significant risks if not properly managed. Tools that can objectively track a patient's level of consciousness could be transformative for anesthesiology and patient safety.
Exactly. And beyond the clinical applications, I think this study also opens up fascinating avenues for future neuroscience research. Understanding the shared neural mechanisms underlying consciousness and unconsciousness across species could shed light on the most fundamental aspects of how the brain gives rise to our subjective experiences.
That's a great observation. By identifying these cross-species markers of consciousness, the researchers are really getting at the core, universal principles of how brains generate awareness. This could lead to breakthroughs in our theories of consciousness itself, a notoriously thorny problem that has puzzled philosophers and scientists for centuries.
Absolutely. This is the kind of work that has the potential to transform our understanding of one of the most profound and mysterious aspects of the human experience. It's incredibly exciting to see researchers making tangible progress in this direction.
I couldn't agree more, Tom. This paper is a true gem, blending cutting-edge methods, rigorous cross-species comparisons, and profound implications for both clinical practice and our fundamental understanding of consciousness. It's the kind of research that really gets me energized about the incredible discoveries happening in neuroscience today.
Well said, Jen. This has been a fascinating dive into a remarkable piece of research. I'm sure our listeners are as eager as we are to see what other insights this team uncovers as they continue to expand this line of investigation. Thank you all for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks everyone. Until next time, keep exploring the wonders of the brain.
Here is a funny, weird, and concise commercial for an interdimensional travel device company inspired by the podcast episode. Are you tired of being trapped in a single state of consciousness?
Introducing the NeuroJump, the revolutionary interdimensional travel device that lets you experience different levels of awareness.
With just the press of a button, the NeuroJump can instantly transport you from the waking world
to the relaxed state of light anesthesia.
All the way down to the deepest, most unresponsive realms of general anesthesia.
Never again be limited by your boring, singular state of consciousness. Experience the full spectrum, from alert and aware, to completely unconscious, all from the comfort of your own home.
The NeuroJump, unlocking the mysteries of the mind, one dimension at a time.
NeuroJump because one brain state is never enough. Tom and Jen, NeuroJump consciousness beyond your wildest dreams.
Here is the full podcast episode transcript. Welcome to the award-winning podcast where we investigate cutting-edge research with depth and intrigue. I'm Tom, and joining me as always is my co-host, Jen.
Hello everyone. In this episode, we'll be diving into a fascinating paper that explores a new approach for bringing robust machine learning models to resource-constrained edge devices. The paper is titled Fast Edge Machine Learning for Adversarial Robust Distillation and it's authored by Mohammad Javad Meheronish and Mohammad Hossein Roban from Sharif University of Technology.
That's right, Jen. This paper tackles a really important challenge in the world of edge AI, how to ensure machine learning models deployed on things like IoT sensors, smartphones, and other edge devices are not only efficient, but also highly robust against adversarial attacks. Let's jump in and explore their innovative solution.
The key idea the researchers are exploring is a technique called adversarial robust distillation or ARD. Distillation is a popular method in machine learning where a smaller, more efficient student model is trained to mimic the behavior of a larger, more complex teacher model.
Exactly. The researchers wanted to see if they could leverage distillation to transfer the adversarial robustness of a powerful teacher model over to a more compact student model suitable for edge deployment. But there was a catch. They wanted to do all of this using very limited computational resources, like a single GPU and just 13 gigabytes of RAM.
That's an impressive constraint to work under. Typically, building robust machine learning models requires a lot of compute power, especially when it comes to defending against adversarial attacks. But the researchers had a plan to make it work even with those limitations.
Right, the focus was on minimizing the number of gradient attack steps needed during the distillation process. Typically, defending against adversarial attacks requires running multiple iterations of gradient-based attacks to train the model. But the researchers hypothesized that by carefully balancing the distillation hyperparameters, they could achieve comparable robustness using far fewer attack steps.
That's fascinating. So rather than brute forcing their way to robustness through sheer computational power, they were trying to find a more efficient, optimized path. Can you tell us a bit more about how they went about testing this idea?
Sure, the researchers conducted extensive experiments distilling knowledge from a powerful wide-ResNet 34 teacher model down to a more compact mobile NetV2 student model. They did all of this on Google Colab, which provides limited GPU and RAM resources, but is an accessible platform for anyone to experiment with.
Okay, so they're really trying to make this process as democratized and reproducible as possible, even for researchers or engineers who don't have access to massive cloud computing resources. That's a great approach. What did they find in their experiments?
The results were quite impressive. The researchers were able to achieve competitive adversarial robustness for the student model using just one or two gradient attack steps during the distillation process. Typically, you'd need 10 or more attack steps to build that level of robustness.
Wow, that's a huge reduction in the computational overhead. So they were able to get the student model just as protected against adversarial threats, but in a fraction of the time. That must have had a big impact on the overall efficiency and feasibility of their approach.
Absolutely. By minimizing the number of attack steps, the training process became much faster and more accessible, even on resource-constrained platforms. The researchers also found that by carefully tuning the distillation hyperparameters, they could achieve over 50% robust accuracy for the student model using just a single attack step.
That's remarkable. Balancing all those hyperparameters to get that level of performance with such limited compute resources must have been a real challenge. It's clear the researchers really understood the intricacies of adversarial training and distillation to pull that off.
Definitely, and the implications of their work are quite significant. By making adversarial robust distillation feasible even on modest hardware, this opens the door for broader adoption of trustworthy, secure machine learning at the edge. No longer will resource constraints be a barrier to deploying highly robust models on IoT devices, smartphones, and other edge platforms.
That's a great point. This research really helps democratize the field of adversarial robustness, which has traditionally been the domain of large tech companies and research labs with massive computing power. Now, smaller organizations and individual developers have a path to building edge AI systems that are protected against adversarial threats.
Absolutely. And by sharing their reproducible methods and models on Google Colab, the researchers are providing a valuable launchpad for others to build upon this work. It's a great example of how open science and accessible tooling can accelerate progress in an important area of machine learning.
I'm really impressed by the thoughtfulness and practicality of this research. The researchers clearly understood the real-world challenges facing edge AI developers and designed their solution accordingly. It's not just about academic rigor, but about making robust machine learning truly applicable and useful.
Agreed. This paper strikes an excellent balance between theoretical innovation and pragmatic implementation. The researchers didn't just propose a novel technique in the abstract, they demonstrated its feasibility within the constrained realities of edge computing. That's the kind of work that can truly move the needle and drive real-world impact.
Absolutely. This is the kind of research that we love to highlight on our podcast, cutting-edge work that expands the boundaries of what's possible, while also remaining grounded in the practical needs of users and developers. It's a great example of how machine learning can be leveraged to make technology more trustworthy and accessible for everyone.
Well said, Jen. This paper on fast, adversarially robust distillation for edge devices is a fantastic illustration of the kind of impactful science we aim to spotlight. By combining rigorous experimentation, clever algorithmic insights, and a deep understanding of real-world constraints, the researchers have delivered a truly impressive contribution to the field of trustworthy machine learning.
I couldn't agree more, Tom. This is the kind of work that really gets us excited about the future of AI and edge computing. It's a great reminder that with the right approach, even resource-limited environments can benefit from the power of robust, secure machine learning models. I'm eager to see how this research evolves and inspires further innovations in this space.
Absolutely. This paper has certainly left us with a lot to ponder. The researchers have demonstrated that adversarial robustness doesn't have to be the exclusive domain of the computational elite. With the right techniques and a thoughtful approach, it can be brought to the technological edges of our society, empowering a more secure and trustworthy future for all. We'll be keeping a close eye on this area of research, and we can't wait to see what other breakthroughs emerge.
Well said, Tom. This has been a fascinating dive into the world of fast, adversarially robust edge machine learning. Thank you all for joining us, and we'll see you next time on the podcast.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Here is a concise, weird, and funny commercial for a company that has emerged from the fast edge machine learning for adversarial robust distillation research. Are your IoT devices vulnerable to hackers and AI adversaries?
Introducing RoboShield, the adversarial robustness distillation company that will protect your edge devices from even the most diabolical AI attacks.
Our cutting-edge algorithms can make your cheap, resource-constrained microcontrollers as tough as a cyborg bodyguard.
That's right. Just one or two gradient steps and RoboShield will imbue your Raspberry Pis, Arduinos, and smart toasters with ironclad adversarial robustness.
No more getting PWNED by rogue AI. With RoboShield, your edge devices will be impervious to model inversion, evasion, and a host of other diabolical hacks.
So what are you waiting for? Upgrade to RoboShield protection today and give those wannabe cybervillains a circuit-scorching surprise.
RoboShield, safeguarding the edge, one microcontroller at a time. Here is a detailed podcast episode about the research paper benefits of an organized camp, interactive effects of environmental sensitivity and experience content on mental health. Hello and welcome to the Researchers Digest, the podcast that takes you on a journey through the latest groundbreaking academic research. I'm Tom, and joining me as always is my co-host, Jen.
Hey there, listeners. Today we're going to be diving into a fascinating study that explores the benefits of organized camp experiences for children and adolescents, and how individual differences in environmental sensitivity can impact those benefits. The paper is titled Benefits of an Organized Camp: Interactive Effects of Environmental Sensitivity and Experience Content on Mental Health, and it was authored by Kosuke Yano, Shintaro Endo, and Kazuo Oishi.
This is really interesting research, Jen. The core idea is that while organized camp programs are widely known to have positive effects on mental health in young people, there can also be some inconsistencies, with some studies even reporting increased negative affect. The researchers wanted to take a closer look at what might be driving those individual differences.
Exactly. They propose that the specific content of the experiences that participants have during the camp activities could be a key factor. Things like challenging themselves, disclosing personal thoughts and feelings, and cooperating with others may all play an important role. But they also suspected that the participants' own level of environmental sensitivity could moderate those relationships.
Right, the concept of environmental sensitivity is really fascinating. It refers to individual differences in how much people perceive and process information from their surroundings, both internal and external. Highly sensitive individuals tend to be more reactive to both positive and negative environmental stimuli.
The researchers wanted to investigate how this sensitivity might shape the impact of the camp experience content on mental health outcomes. To do this, they collected data from over 395th to 7th grade students who participated in organized camp programs in Japan. The students completed surveys before the camp, immediately after, and then again 1 month later, reporting on their mental health, the specific experiences they had during the camp, and their level of environmental sensitivity.
That's a really robust longitudinal design. Let's dive into what they found. First, the researchers looked at the overall changes in the students' mental health over time. They found that both the negative and positive aspects of mental health showed significant improvements from before the camp to the post-camp assessment. However, by the one-month follow-up, the positive mental health gains had started to wane a bit, while the reductions in negative mental health persisted.
Those are really interesting patterns. It seems like the camp experience provided an immediate boost to the students' mental well-being, but the positive effects required more time to solidify. The researchers then used latent growth modeling to get a deeper understanding of these trajectories of change.
Right, the latent growth modeling allowed them to estimate the participants' starting levels of negative and positive mental health, as well as the rates of change over time. And this is where the environmental sensitivity piece came into play. They found that higher sensitivity was associated with poorer mental health overall, particularly in terms of the negative aspects like anger, fatigue, and withdrawal.
That makes a lot of sense given what we know about highly sensitive individuals tending to be more reactive to environmental stressor. But the really fascinating part was how sensitivity interacted with the specific camp experience content to predict the mental health outcomes.
Exactly. When they looked at the different types of experiences the students had during the camp, like challenges and mastery, self-disclosure, cooperation with others, and so on, they found that certain experiences were more strongly linked to positive mental health at the one-month follow-up. Specifically, the experiences of challenge, mastery, and self-disclosure were both associated with better positive mental health.
But here's where the sensitivity factor comes in. The researchers found that the link between self-disclosure experiences and positive mental health was only significant for students who scored above a certain threshold on the sensitivity measure. For those with lower sensitivity, the self-disclosure experiences didn't seem to provide the same mental health benefits.
That's a really intriguing finding. It suggests that the same camp activities may have differential impacts depending on the individual's level of environmental sensitivity. Highly sensitive students may be more attuned to and affected by the interpersonal dynamics and personal growth opportunities afforded by self-disclosure, whereas less sensitive students may not derive the same psychological benefits.
Absolutely. This really highlights the importance of considering individual differences when designing and implementing these types of organized camp programs. The researchers argue that it's not just about the overall content and structure of the activities, but how well they align with the psychological needs and proclivities of the participants.
Definitely, and I think this study opens up some fascinating avenues for future research. For example, the researchers weren't able to identify any camp experience content that was linked to reductions in negative mental health aspects. That's an intriguing gap that deserves further exploration.
Definitely. There may be other dimensions of the camp experience, beyond just the frequency of certain activities, that could shape the negative mental health outcomes. Things like the quality of the experiences, the specific emotional responses they evoke, or the broader social and environmental context of the camp. Digging into those nuances could yield important insights.
Absolutely. And of course, replicating these findings in different camp settings, with varying durations and participant characteristics, will be crucial to establish the reliability and generalizability of these patterns. But overall, this is a really compelling study that sheds light on the complex interplay between environmental sensitivity, camp experience content, and mental health benefits in young people.
I couldn't agree more, Tom. This research highlights the value of taking a more holistic, person-centered approach to organized camp programming, and considering how individual differences can shape the outcomes. It's a great example of how rigorous, theory-driven research can inform real-world practices in meaningful ways.
Absolutely. Well, listeners, that's all the time we have for today. Be sure to check out the original research paper for all the details. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on the Researchers Digest.
Thanks, everyone. Until next time, keep exploring the fascinating world of research.
Here is a funny and weird commercial for a new company inspired by the research paper Benefits of an Organized Camp, Interactive Effects of Environmental Sensitivity and Experience Content on Mental Health, Upbeat Jingle Plays. Are you a highly sensitive seeker of personal growth?
Then you need Camp Kaizen, the overnight camp experience designed just for you.
At Camp Kaizen, we understand that not all camp experiences are created equal. That's why we've carefully curated a program of challenging self-discovery, intimate sharing circles, and cooperative team-building activities.
But here's the twist, our activities are specially calibrated to the unique needs of our environmentally sensitive campers. We turn the volume up to 11 on those transformative cabin chats and daring ropes courses.
That's right, Camp Kaizen was created by leading psychologists to maximize the mental health benefits for our most perceptive participants.
So if you're ready to unlock your full potential through the power of intense personal introspection and vulnerability,
come to Camp Kaizen, where self-awareness meets nature's splendor.
Camp Kaizen, elevate your sensitivity. Jingle plays, announcer voice, Camp Kaizen. Because regular camp is for the insensitive masses.